it. Now, this appears to me a case of misdirected energy, which has a certain amount of reason in it, and a certain amount of romance. And I don't know but what I should be more interested in our young friend as an illustration of such a case than merely as a poor vagabond, which anyone can be. In the meantime, I ventured to observe, he is getting worse. In the meantime, said Mr. Skimpole cheerfully, as Miss Summerson, with her practical good sense, observes, he is getting worse. Therefore, I recommend your turning him out before he gets still worse. The amiable face with which he said it, I think I shall never forget. Of course, little woman, observed my guardian, turning to me, I can ensure his admission into the proper place by merely going there to enforce it, though it's a bad state of things when, in his condition, that is necessary. But it's growing late, and is a very bad night, and the boy is worn out already. There is a bed in the wholesome loft room by the stable. We had better keep him there till morning, when he can be wrapped up and removed. We'll do that.
Oh,
said Mr. Skimpole, with his hands upon the keys of the piano as we moved away. Are you going back to our young friend?
Yes,
said my guardian.
How I envy you your constitution, Jarndyce,
returned Mr. Skimpole with playful admiration.
You don't mind these things. Neither does Miss Summerson. You are ready at all times to go anywhere and do anything. Such is will. I've no will at all, and no won't. Simply can't.
You can't recommend anything for the boy, I suppose?
Said my guardian, looking back over his shoulder half angrily, only half angrily, for he never seemed to consider Mr. Skimpole an accountable being.
My dear Jarndyce, I observed a bottle of cooling medicine in his pocket, and it's impossible for him to do better than take it. You can tell them to sprinkle a little vinegar about the place where he sleeps, and to keep it moderately cool and him moderately warm, but it is mere impertinence in me to offer any recommendation. Miss Summerson has such a knowledge of detail, and such a capacity for the administration of detail, that she knows all about it.
We went back into the hall and explained to Joe what we proposed to do, which Charlie explained to him again, and which he received with the languid unconcern I had already noticed, wearily looking on at what was done as if it were for somebody else. The servants, compassionating his miserable state, and being very anxious to help, we soon got the loft room ready, and some of the men about the house carried him across the wet yard well wrapped up. It was pleasant to observe how kind they were to him, and how there appeared to be a general impression among them that frequently calling him old chap was likely to revive his spirits. Charlie directed the operations and went to and fro between the loft room and the house with such little stimulants and comforts as we thought it safe to give him. My guardian himself saw him before he was left for the night and reported to me when he returned to the growlery to write a letter on the boy's behalf, which a messenger was charged to deliver at daylight in the morning, that he seemed easier and inclined to sleep. They had fastened his door on the outside, he said, in case of his being delirious, but had so arranged that he could not make any noise without being heard. Ada being in our room with a cold, Mr. Skimpole was left alone all this time, and entertained himself by playing snatches of pathetic airs, and sometimes singing to them, as we heard at a distance, with great expression and feeling. When we rejoined him in the drawing-room, he said he would give us a little ballad, which had come into his head apropos of our young friend, and he sang one about a peasant boy. Thrown on the wide world, doomed to wander and roam, bereft of his parents, bereft of a home. Quite exquisitely. It was a song that always made him cry, he told us. He was extremely gay all the rest of the evening, for he absolutely chirped, those were his delighted words, when he thought by what a happy talent for business he was surrounded. He gave us, in his glass of negus, better health to our young friend, and supposed and gaily pursued the case of his being reserved, like Whittington, to become Lord Mayor of London. In that event, no doubt, he would establish the Jarndyce Institution and the Summerson Almshouses, and a little annual corporation pilgrimage to St. Albans. He had no doubt, he said, that our young friend was an excellent boy in his way, but his way was not the Harold Skimpole way. What Harold Skimpole was, Harold Skimpole had found himself, to his considerable surprise, when he first made his own acquaintance. He had accepted himself with all his failings, and had thought it sound philosophy to make the best of the bargain. And he hoped we would do the same. Charlie's last report was that the boy was quiet. I could see from my window the lantern they had left him burning quietly, and I went to bed very happy to think that he was sheltered. There was more movement and more talking than usual a little before daybreak, and it awoke me. As I was dressing, I looked out of my window, and asked one of our men who had been among the active sympathisers last night whether there was anything wrong about the house. The lantern was still burning in the loft window.
"It's the boy, miss," said he.
"Is he worse?" I inquired.
"Gone, miss."
"Dead?"
"Dead, miss.
No, gone, clean off."
At what time of the night he had gone, or how, or why, it seemed hopeless ever to divine. The door remaining as it had been left, and the lantern standing in the window, it could only be supposed that he had got out by a trap in the floor, which communicated with an empty cart-house below. But he had shut it down again, if that were so, and it looked as if it had not been raised. Nothing of any kind was missing. On this fact being clearly ascertained, we all yielded to the painful belief that delirium had come upon him in the night, and that, allured by some imaginary object, or pursued by some imaginary horror, he had strayed away in that worse-than-helpless state. All of us, that is to say, but Mr. Skimpole, who repeatedly suggested, in his usual easy, light style, that it had occurred to our young friend that he was not a safe inmate, having a bad kind of fever upon him, and that he had, with great natural politeness, taken himself off. Every possible inquiry was made, and every place was searched. The brick kilns were examined, the cottages were visited, the two women were particularly questioned, but they knew nothing of him, and nobody could doubt that their wonder was genuine. The weather had for some time been too wet, and the night itself had been too wet to admit of any tracing by footsteps. Hedge and ditch and wall and rick and stack were examined by our men for a long distance round, lest the boy should be lying in such a place insensible or dead. But nothing was seen to indicate that he had ever been near. From the time when he was left in the loft room, he vanished. The search continued for 5 days. I do not mean that it ceased even then, but that my attention was then diverted into a current very memorable to me. As Charlie was at her writing again in my room in the evening, and as I sat opposite to her at work, I felt the table tremble. Looking up, I saw my little maid shivering from head to foot.
"Charlie," said I, "are you so cold?"
"I think I am, miss," she replied. "I don't know what it is. I can't hold myself still. I felt so yesterday at about this same time, miss. Don't be uneasy. I think I'm ill."
I heard Ada's voice outside, and I hurried to the door of communication between my room and our pretty sitting-room and locked it, just in time, for she tapped at it while my hand was yet upon the key. Ada called to me to let her in, but I said,
"Not now, my dearest, go away. There's nothing the matter, I will come to you presently."
Ah, it was a long, long time before my darling girl and I were companions again. Charlie fell ill. In 12 hours she was very ill. I moved her to my room and laid her in my bed and sat down quietly to nurse her. I told my guardian all about it, and why I felt it was necessary that I should seclude myself, and my reason for not seeing my darling above all. At first she came very often to the door and called to me, and even reproached me with sobs and tears. But I wrote her a long letter, saying that she made me anxious and unhappy, and imploring her, as she loved me and wished my mind to be at peace, to come no nearer than the garden. After that she came beneath the window even oftener than she had come to the door, and if I had learnt to love her dear sweet voice before, when we were hardly ever apart, how did I learn to love it then, when I stood behind the window curtain, listening and replying, but not so much as looking out? How did I learn to love it afterwards, when the harder time came? They put a bed for me in our sitting-room, and by keeping the door wide open, I turned the two rooms into one, now that Ada had vacated that part of the house, and kept them always fresh and airy. There was not a servant in or about the house, but was so good that they would all most gladly have come to me at any hour of the day or night, without the least fear or unwillingness. But I thought it best to choose one worthy woman who was never to see Ada, and whom I could trust to come and go with all precaution. Through her means, I got out to take the air with my guardian when there was no fear of meeting Ada, and wanted for nothing in the way of attendance, any more than in any other respect. And thus poor Charlie sickened and grew worse, and fell into heavy danger of death, and lay severely ill for many a long round of day and night. So patient she was, so uncomplaining, and inspired by such a gentle fortitude that very often, as I sat by Charlie holding her head in my arms, repose would come to her so, when it would come to her in no other attitude, I silently prayed to our Father in heaven that I might not forget the lesson which this little sister taught me. I was very sorrowful to think that Charlie's pretty looks would change and be disfigured even if she recovered. She was such a child with her dimpled face. But that thought was, for the greater part, lost in her greater peril. When she was at the worst, and her mind rambled again to the cares of her father's sick bed and the little children, she still knew me so far as that she would be quiet in my arms when she could lie quiet nowhere else, and murmur out the wanderings of her mind less restlessly. At those times I used to think, how should I ever tell the two remaining babies that the baby who had learned of her faithful heart to be a mother to them in their need was dead? There were other times when Charlie knew me well and talked to me, telling me that she sent her love to Tom and Emma, and that she was sure Tom would grow up to be a good man. At those times Charlie would speak to me of what she had read to her father as well as she could to comfort him, of that young man carried out to be buried, who was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, of the ruler's daughter raised up by the gracious hand upon her bed of death. And Charlie told me that when her father died, she had kneeled down and prayed in her first sorrow that he likewise might be raised up and given back to his poor children, and that if she should never get better and should die too, she thought it likely that it might come into Tom's mind to offer the same prayer for her. Then would I show Tom how these people of old days had been brought back to life on earth, only that we might know our hope to be restored to heaven. But of all the various times there were in Charlie's illness, there was not one when she lost the gentle qualities I have spoken of. And there were many, many, when I thought in the night of the last high belief in the watching angel, and the last higher trust in God on the part of her poor despised father. And Charlie did not die. She flutteringly and slowly turned the dangerous point, after long lingering there, and then began to mend. The hope that never had been given from the first, of Charlie being in outward appearance Charlie any more, soon began to be encouraged, and even that prospered, and I saw her growing into her old childish likeness again. It was a great morning when I could tell Ada all this as she stood out in the garden, and it was a great evening when Charlie and I at last took tea together in the next room. But on that same evening I felt that I was stricken cold. Happily for both of us, it was not until Charlie was safe in bed again and placidly asleep that I began to think the contagion of her illness was upon me. I had been able easily to hide what I felt at tea-time, but I was past that already now, and I knew that I was rapidly following in Charlie's steps. I was well enough, however, to be up early in the morning, and to return my darling's cheerful blessing from the garden, and to talk with her as long as usual. But I was not free from an impression that I had been walking about the two rooms in the night, a little beside myself, though knowing where I was. And I felt confused at times, with a curious sense of fullness, as if I were becoming too large altogether. In the evening I was so much worse that I resolved to prepare Charlie, with which view I said, "You're getting quite strong, Charlie, are you not?" "Oh, quite," said Charlie. "Strong enough to be told a secret, I think, Charlie." "Quite strong enough for that, miss," cried Charlie. But Charlie's face fell in the height of her delight, for she saw the secret in my face, and she came out of the great chair and fell upon my bosom and said, "Oh, miss, it's my doing, it's my doing," and a great deal more out of the fullness of her grateful heart. "Now, Charlie," said I, after letting her go on for a little while, "if I am to be ill, my great trust, humanly speaking, is in you. And unless you are as quiet and composed for me as you always were for yourself, you can never fulfil it, Charlie."
"If you'll let me cry a little longer, miss," said Charlie. "Oh, my dear, if you'll only let me cry a little longer. Oh, my dear."
How affectionately and devotedly she poured this out as she clung to my neck. I never can remember without tears.
"I'll be good."
So I let Charlie cry a little longer, and it did us both good.
"Trust in me now, if you please, miss," said Charlie quietly. "I'm listening to everything you say."
"It's very little at present, Charlie. I shall tell your doctor tonight that I don't think I am well, and that you are going to nurse me." For that the poor child thanked me with her whole heart. "And in the morning, when you hear Miss Ada in the garden, if I should not be quite able to go to the window curtain as usual, do you go, Charlie, and say I am asleep, that I have rather tired myself and am asleep. At all times keep the room as I have kept it, Charlie,
and let no one come." Charlie promised, and I lay down, for I was very heavy. I saw the doctor that night, and asked the favour of him that I wished to ask relative to his saying nothing of my illness in the house as yet. I have a very indistinct remembrance of that night melting into day, and of day melting into night again, but I was just able, on the first morning, to get to the window and speak to my darling. On the second morning I heard her dear voice, oh how dear now, outside, and I asked Charlie with some difficulty, speech being painful to me, to go and say I was asleep. I heard her answer softly, "Don't disturb her, Charlie, for the world." "How does my own pride look, Charlie?" I inquired. "Disappointed, miss," said Charlie, peeping through the curtain. "But I know she is very beautiful this morning." "She is indeed, miss," answered Charlie, peeping, still looking up at the window. With her blue, clear eyes, God bless them, always loveliest when raised like that. I called Charlie to me and gave her her last charge. "Now, Charlie, when she knows I am ill, she will try to make her way into the room. Keep her out, Charlie, if you love me truly, to the last. Charlie, if you let her in but once, only to look upon me for one moment as I lie here, I shall die." "I never will. I never will," she promised me. "I believe it, my dear Charlie. And now come and sit beside me for a little while, and touch me with your hand. For I cannot see you, Charlie. I am blind." Chapter 32. The Appointed Time. It is night in Lincoln's Inn, perplexed and troublous valley of the shadow of the law, where suitors generally find but little day, and fat candles are snuffed out in offices, and clerks have rattled down the crazy wooden stairs and dispersed. The bell that rings at 9 o'clock has ceased its doleful clangour about nothing. The gates are shut, and the night porter, a solemn warder with a mighty power of sleep, keeps guard in his lodge. From tiers of staircase windows clogged lamps, like the eyes of equity, bleared Argus with a fathomless pocket for every eye, and an eye upon it, dimly blink at the stars. In dirty upper casements here and there, hazy little patches of candlelight reveal where some wise draughtsman and conveyancer yet toils for the entanglement of real estate in meshes of sheepskin, in the average ratio of about a dozen of sheep to an acre of land, over which bee-like industry these benefactors of their species linger yet, though office hours be past, that they may give for every day some good account at last. In the neighbouring court, where the Lord Chancellor of the Rag and Bottle Shop dwells, there is a general tendency towards beer and supper. Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins, whose respective sons, engaged with a circle of acquaintance in the game of hide-and-seek, have been lying in ambush about the byways of Chancery Lane for some hours, and scouring the plain of the same thoroughfare to the confusion of passengers, Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins have but now exchanged congratulations on the children being abed, and they still linger on the doorstep over a few parting words. Mr. Crook and his lodger, and the fact of Mr. Crook's being continually in liquor, and the testamentary prospects of the young man are, as usual, the staple of their conversation. But they have something to say, likewise, of the harmonic meeting at the Sol's Arms, where the sound of the piano through the partly opened windows jingles out into the court, and where little Swills, after keeping the lovers of harmony in a roar like a very Yorick, may now be heard taking the gruff line in a concerted piece, and sentimentally adjuring his friends and patrons to "Listen, listen, listen, to the waterfall." Mrs. Perkins and Mrs. Piper compare opinions on the subject of the young lady of professional celebrity who assists at the harmonic meetings, and who has a space to herself in the manuscript announcement in the window. Mrs. Perkins possessing information that she has been married a year and a half, though announced as Miss M. Melvilleson, the noted siren, and that her baby is clandestinely conveyed to the Sol's Arms every night to receive its natural nourishment during the entertainments. "Sooner than which myself," says Mrs. Perkins, "I'll get my living by selling lucifers." Mrs. Piper, as in duty bound, is of the same opinion, holding that a private station is better than public applause, and thanking heaven for her own, and by implication, Mrs. Perkins, respectability.
By this time the potboy of the Sol's Arms appearing with her supper pint well frothed, Mrs. Piper accepts that tankard and retires indoors, first giving a fair good night to Mrs. Perkins, who has had her own pint in her hand ever since it was fetched from the same hostelry by young Perkins before he was sent to bed. Now there is the sound of putting up shop shutters in the court, and a smell as of the smoking of pipes, and shooting stars are seen in upper windows, further indicating retirement to rest. Now, too, the policeman begins to push at doors, to try fastenings, to be suspicious of bundles, and to administer his beat on the hypothesis that everyone is either robbing or being robbed. It is a close night, though the damp cold is searching too, and there is a laggard mist a little way up in the air. It is a fine steaming night to turn the slaughterhouses, the unwholesome trades, the sewerage, bad water and burial grounds to account, and give the Registrar of Deaths some extra business. It may be something in the air, there is plenty in it, or it may be something in himself that is in fault, but Mr. Weevil, otherwise Jobling, is very ill at ease. He comes and goes between his own room and the open street door 20 times an hour. He has been doing so ever since it fell dark. Since the Chancellor shut up his shop, which he did very early tonight, Mr. Weevil has been down and up and down and up, with a cheap, tight velvet skull-cap on his head, making his whiskers look out of all proportion, oftener than before. It is no phenomenon that Mr. Snagsby should be ill at ease, too, for he always is so, more or less, under the oppressive influence of the secret that is upon him. Impelled by the mystery of which he is a partaker, and yet in which he is not a sharer, Mr. Snagsby haunts what seems to be its fountainhead, the rag and bottle shop in the court. It has an irresistible attraction for him. Even now, coming round by the Sol's Arms, with the intention of passing down the court and out at the Chancery Lane end, and so terminating his unpremeditated after-supper stroll of 10 minutes long from his own door and back again, Mr. Snagsby approaches.
"What, Mr. Weevil?" says the stationer, stopping to speak. "Are you there?"
"Aye," says Weevil. "Here I am, Mr. Snagsby."
"Airing yourself, as I'm doing, before you go to bed?" the stationer inquires.
"Why, there's not much air to be got here, and what there is not very refreshing," Weevil answers, glancing up and down the court.
"Very true, sir. Don't you observe," says Mr. Snagsby, pausing to sniff and taste the air a little, "don't you observe, Mr. Weevil, that you're, not to put too fine a point upon it, that you're rather greasy here, sir?"
"Why, I have noticed myself that there is a queer kind of flavour in the place tonight," Mr. Weevil rejoins. "I suppose it's chops at the Sol's Arms."
"Chops, do you think?" "Oh, chops, eh?" Mr. Snagsby sniffs and tastes again. "Well, sir, I suppose it is. But I should say their cook at the Sol wanted a little looking after. She's been burning 'em, sir, and I don't think—" Mr. Snagsby sniffs and tastes again, and then spits and wipes his mouth. "I don't think, not to put too fine a point upon it, that they were quite fresh when they were shown the gridiron."
"That's very likely. It's a tainting sort of weather."
"It is a tainting sort of weather," says Mr. Snagsby, "and I find it sinking to the spirits."
"By George, I find it gives me the horrors," returns Mr. Weevil.
"Then, you see, you live in a lonesome way, and in a lonesome room, with a black circumstance hanging over it," says Mr. Snagsby, looking in past the other's shoulder along the dark passage, and then falling back a step to look up at the house.
"I couldn't live in that room alone, as you do, sir. I shall get so fidgety and worried of an evening sometimes that I shall be driven to come to the door and stand here sooner than sit there. But then it's very true that you didn't see in your room what I saw there. That makes a difference."
"I know quite enough about it," returns Tony.
"It's not agreeable, is it?" pursues Mr. Snagsby, coughing his cough of mild persuasion behind his hand. "Mr. Crook ought to consider it in the rent. I hope he does, I'm sure."
"I hope he does," says Tony. "But I doubt it."
"You find the rent too high, do you, sir?" returns the stationer. "Rents are high about here. I don't know how it is exactly, but the law seems to put things up in price. Not," adds Mr. Snagsby with his apologetic cough, "that I mean to say a word against the profession I get my living by." Mr. Weevil again glances up and down the court, and then looks at the stationer. Mr. Snagsby, blankly catching his eye, looks upward for a star or so, and coughs a cough expressive of not exactly seeing his way out of this conversation. "It's a curious fact, sir," he observes, slowly rubbing his hands, "that he should have been—"
"Who's he?"
interrupts Mr. Weevil. "The deceased, you know," says Mr. Snagsby, twitching his head and right eyebrow towards the staircase and tapping his acquaintance on the button.
"Oh, to be sure,"
returns the other, as if he were not over-fond of the subject.
"I thought we had done with him."
"I was only going to say it's a curious fact, sir, that he should have come and lived here and been one of my writers, and then that you should come and live here and be one of my writers too, which there is nothing derogatory, but far from it in the appellation," says Mr. Snagsby, breaking off with a mistrust that he may have unpolitely asserted a kind of proprietorship in Mr. Weevil, "because I have known writers that have gone into brewers' houses and done really very respectable indeed, eminently respectable, sir," adds Mr. Snagsby, with a misgiving that he has not improved the matter.
"It's a curious coincidence, as you say,"
answers Weevil, once more glancing up and down the court. "Seems a fate in it, don't there?" suggests the stationer.
"There does."
"Just so," observes the stationer, with his confirmatory cough. "Quite a fate in it. Quite a fate. Well, Mr. Weevil, I'm afraid I must bid you good night." Mr. Snagsby speaks as if it made him desolate to go, though he's been casting about for any means of escape ever since he stopped to speak. "My little woman will be looking for me else. Good night, sir." If Mr. Snagsby hastens home to save his little woman the trouble of looking for him, he might set his mind at rest on that score. His little woman has had her eye upon him round the Sol's Arms all this time, and now glides after him with a pocket handkerchief wrapped over her head, honouring Mr. Weevil and his doorway with a searching glance as she goes past.
"You'll know me again, ma'am, at all events," says Mr. Weevil to himself, "and I can't compliment you on your appearance, whoever you are, with your head tied up in a bundle. Is this fellow never coming?"
This fellow approaches as he speaks. Mr. Weevil softly holds up his finger and draws him into the passage and closes the street door. Then they go upstairs. Mr. Weevil heavily, and Mr. Guppy, for it is he, very lightly indeed. When they are shut into the back room, they speak low.
"I thought you had gone to Jericho at least instead of coming here,"
says Tony. "Why, I said about 10.
"You've said about 10,
Tony repeats.
"Yes, so you did say about 10. But according to my account, it's 10 times 10. It's 100 o'clock. I never had such a night in my life."
"What's been the matter?"
"That's it," says Tony. "Nothing has been the matter. But here have I been stewing and fuming in this jolly old crib till I've had the horrors falling on me as thick as hail. There's a blessed-looking candle," says Tony, pointing to the heavily burning taper on his table with a great cabbage head and a long winding sheet.
"That's easily improved," Mr. Guppy observes, as he takes the snuffers in hand.
"Is it?"
returns his friend.
"Not so easily as you think. It has been smouldering like that ever since it was lighted."
"Why, what's the matter with you, Tony?" inquires Mr. Guppy, looking at him, snuffers in hand, as he sits down with his elbow on the table.
"William Guppy," replies the other, "I am in the Downs. It's this unbearably dull, suicidal room. An old bogey downstairs, I suppose."
Mr. Weevil moodily pushes the snuffers tray from him with his elbow, leans his head on his hand, puts his feet on the fender, and looks at the fire. Mr. Guppy, observing him, slightly tosses his head and sits down on the other side of the table in an easy attitude.
"Wasn't that Snagsby talking to you, Tony?"
"Yes, and he—yes, it was Snagsby,"
said Mr. Weevil, altering the construction of his sentence.
"On business?"
"No, no business. He was only sauntering by and stopped to prose."
"I thought it was Snagsby," says Mr. Guppy, "and thought it as well that he shouldn't see me, so I waited till he was gone."
"There we go again, William G.,"
cried Tony, looking up for an instant.
"So mysterious and secret. My George, if we were going to commit a murder, we couldn't have more mystery about it."
Mr. Guppy affects to smile, and with the view of changing the conversation, looks with an admiration, real or pretended, round the room at the Galaxy Gallery of British Beauty, terminating his survey with a portrait of Lady Dedlock over the mantelshelf, in which she is represented on a terrace, with a pedestal upon the terrace, and a vase upon the pedestal, and her shawl upon the vase, and a prodigious piece of fur upon the shawl, and her arm on a prodigious piece of fur, and a bracelet on her arm.
"That's very like Lady Dedlock," says Mr. Guppy. "It's a speaking likeness."
"I wish it was,"
growls Tony, without changing his position.
"I should have some fashionable conversation here then."
Finding by this time that his friend is not to be wheedled into a more sociable humour, Mr. Guppy puts about upon the ill-used tack and remonstrates with him. "Tony," says he, "I can make allowances for lowness of spirits, for no man knows what it is when it does come upon a man better than I do, and no man perhaps has a better right to know it than a man who has an unrequited image imprinted on his heart. But there are bounds to these things when an unoffending party is in question, and I will acknowledge to you, Tony, that I don't think your manner on the present occasion is hospitable or quite gentlemanly."
"This is strong language, William Guppy," returns Mr. Weevil.
"Sir, it may be," retorts Mr. William Guppy, "but I feel strongly when I use it." Mr. Weevil admits that he has been wrong, and begs Mr. William Guppy to think no more about it. Mr. William Guppy, however, having got the advantage, cannot quite release it without a little more injured remonstrance.
"No, dash it, Tony," says that gentleman, "you really ought to be careful how you wound the feelings of a man who has an unrequited image imprinted on his heart, and who is not altogether happy in those chords which vibrate to the tenderest emotions. You, Tony, possess in yourself all that is calculated to charm the eye and allure the taste. It is not, happily for you perhaps, and I may wish that I could say the same, it is not your character to hover around one flower. The old garden is open to you, and your airy pinions carry you through it. Still, Tony, far be it from me, I'm sure, to wound even your feelings without a cause."
Tony again entreats that the subject may be no longer pursued, saying emphatically,
"William Guppy, drop it."
Mr. Guppy acquiesces, with the reply, "I never should have taken it up, Tony, of my own accord."
"And now," says Tony, stirring the fire, "touching this same bundle of letters, isn't it an extraordinary thing of Crook to have appointed 12 o'clock tonight to hand 'em over to me?"
"Very. What did he do it for?"
"What does he do anything for? He don't know. Said today was his birthday, and he'd hand 'em over tonight at 12 o'clock. He'd have drunk himself blind by that time. He's been at it all day."
"He hasn't forgotten the appointment, I hope."
"Forgotten? Trust him for that. He never forgets anything. I saw him tonight about 8, helped him to shut up his shop, and he had got the letters then in his hairy cap. He pulled it off and showed 'em me. When the shop was closed, he took them out of his cap, hung his cap on the chair back, and stood turning them over before the fire. I heard him a little while afterwards, through the floor here, humming like the wind, the only song he knows, about Bebo and old Karen, and Bebo being drunk when he died, or something or other. He's been as quiet since as an old rat asleep in his hole."
"Are you to go down at 12?
"At 12. And as I tell you, when you came, it seemed to me 100.
"Tony," says Mr. Guppy, after considering a little with his legs crossed, "he can't read yet, can he?"
"Read? He'll never read. He can make all the letters separately, and he knows most of them separately when he sees them. He's got on that much under me, but he can't put them together. He's too old to acquire the knack of it now, and too drunk."
"Tony," says Mr. Guppy, uncrossing and recrossing his legs, "how do you suppose he spelt out that name of Hawden?"
"He never spelt it out. You know what a curious power of eye he has, and how he's been used to employ himself in copying things by eye alone. He imitated it, evidently from the direction of a letter, and asked me what it meant."
"Tony," says Mr. Guppy, uncrossing and recrossing his legs again, "should you say that the original was a man's writing, or a woman's?"
"A woman's. 50 to 1 a lady's. Slopes a good deal, and the end of the letter N, long and hasty."
Mr. Guppy has been biting his thumbnail during this dialogue, generally changing the thumb when he has changed the cross leg. As he is going to do so again, he happens to look at his coat sleeve. It takes his attention. He stares at it, aghast. "Why, Tony, what on earth is going on in this house tonight? Is there a chimney on fire?"
"Chimney on fire?"
"Ah!" returns Mr. Guppy. "See how the soot's falling. See it on my arm. See again on the table here. Confound the stuff, it won't blow off. Smears like black fat." They look at one another, and Tony goes listening to the door, and a little way upstairs, and a little way downstairs. Comes back and says it's all right, and all quiet, and quotes the remark he lately made to Mr. Snagsby about their cooking chops at the Sol's Arms. "And it was then," resumes Mr. Guppy, still glancing with remarkable aversion at the coat sleeve, as they pursue their conversation before the fire, leaning on opposite sides of the table, with their heads very near together, "that he told you of his having taken the bundle of letters from his lodger's portmanteau?"
"That was the time, sir," answers Tony,
faintly adjusting his whiskers.
Whereupon I wrote a line to my dear boy, the Honourable William Guppy, informing him of the appointment for tonight, and advising him not to call before, Bogey being a sly boots.
The light, vivacious tone of fashionable life, which is usually assumed by Mr. Weevil, sits so ill upon him tonight that he abandons that and his whiskers together, and after looking over his shoulder, appears to yield himself up a prey to the horrors again.
You are to bring the letters to your room to read and compare, and to get yourself into a position to tell him all about them. That's the arrangement, isn't it, Tony?
Asks Mr. Guppy, anxiously biting his thumbnail.
You can't speak too low. Yes, that's what he and I agreed.
I'll tell you what, Tony.
You can't speak too low, says Tony once more.
Mr. Guppy nods his sagacious head, advances it yet closer, and drops into a whisper.
I'll tell you what. The first thing to be done is to make another packet, like the real one, so that if he should ask to see the real one while it's in my possession, you can show him the dummy.
And suppose he detects the dummy as soon as he sees it, which with his biting screw of an eye is about 500 times more likely than not, suggests Tony.
Then we'll face it out. They don't belong to him, and they never did. You found that, and you placed them in my hands, a legal friend of yours, for security. If he forces us to it, they'll be producible, won't they?
Yes, is Mr. Weevil's reluctant admission.
Why, Tony, remonstrates his friend, how you look. You don't doubt William Guppy. You don't suspect any harm.
I don't suspect anything more than I know, William, returns the other gravely.
And what do you know?
Urges Mr. Guppy, raising his voice a little. But on his friend's once more warning him,
I'll tell you, you can't speak too low.
He repeats his question without any sound at all, forming with his lips only the words,
What do you know?
I know three things. First, I know that here we are whispering in secrecy a pair of conspirators.
Well, says Mr. Guppy, and we had better be that than a pair of noodles, which we should be if we were doing anything else, for it's the only way of doing what we want to do. Secondly?
Secondly, it's not made out to me how it's likely to be profitable after all.
Mr. Guppy casts up his eyes at the portrait of Lady Dedlock over the mantel-shelf, and replies,
Tony, you were asked to leave that to the honour of your friend. Besides, it's being calculated to serve that friend in those chords of the human mind which need not be called into agonising vibration on the present occasion. Your friend is no fool. What's that?
It's 11 o'clock striking by the bell of St. Paul's. Listen, and you'll hear all the bells in the city jangling.
Both sit silent, listening to the metal voices near and distant, resounding from towers of various heights, in tones more various than their situations. When these at length cease, all seems more mysterious and quiet than before. One disagreeable result of whispering is that it seems to evoke an atmosphere of silence, haunted by the ghosts of sound, strange cracks and tickings, the rustling of garments that have no substance in them, and the tread of dreadful feet that would leave no mark on the sea-sand or the winter snow. So sensitive the two friends happen to be that the air is full of these phantoms, and the two look over their shoulders by one consent to see that the door is shut.
"Yes, Tony?"
says Mr. Guppy, drawing nearer to the fire and biting his unsteady thumbnail.
"You were going to say, thirdly?"
It's far from a pleasant thing to be plotting about a dead man in the room where he died, especially when you happen to live in it.
But we are plotting nothing against him, Tony.
Maybe not. Still, I don't like it. Live here by yourself and see how you like it.
As to dead men, Tony, proceeds Mr. Guppy, evading this proposal, there have been dead men in most rooms.
I know there have, but in most rooms you let them alone, and they let you alone, Tony answers.
The two look at each other again. Mr. Guppy makes a hurried remark to the effect that they may be doing the deceased a service, that he hopes so. There is an oppressive blank until Mr. Weevil, by stirring the fire suddenly, makes Mr. Guppy start as if his heart had been stirred instead.
"Bah, here's more of this hateful soot hanging about," says he. "Let's open the window a bit and get a mouthful of air. It's too close."
He raises the sash, and they both rest on the window-sill, half in and half out of the room. The neighbouring houses are too near to admit of their seeing any sky without craning their necks and looking up. But lights in frowsy windows here and there, and the rolling of distant carriages, and the new expression that there is of the stir of men, they find to be comfortable, Mr. Guppy, noiselessly tapping on the window-sill, resumes his whispering in quite a light comedy tone. "By the by, Tony, don't forget old Smallweed, meaning the younger of that name. I've not let him into this, you know. That grandfather of his is too keen by half. It runs in the family."
"I remember," says Tony. "I'm up to all that."
"And as to Crook," resumes Mr. Guppy, "now, do you suppose he really has got hold of any other papers of importance, as he has boasted to you, since you've been such allies?" Tony shakes his head.
"I don't know. Can't imagine. If we get through this business without rousing his suspicions, I shall be better informed, no doubt. How can I know without seeing them when he don't know himself? He's always spelling out words from them, and chalking them over the table and the shop wall, and asking what this is and what that is. But his whole stock from beginning to end may easily be the waste paper he brought it as, for anything I can say. It's a monomania with him to think he is possessed of documents. He's been going to learn to read them this last quarter of a century, I should judge, from what he tells me."
"How did he first come by that idea, though? That's the question," Mr. Guppy suggests, with one eye shut, after a little forensic meditation. "He may have found papers in something he bought, where papers were not supposed to be, and may have got it into his shrewd head from the manner and place of their concealment that they are worth something."
"Or he may have been taken in some pretended bargain. Or he may have been muddled altogether by long staring at whatever he has got, and by drink, and by hanging about the Lord Chancellor's court and hearing of documents for ever," returns Mr. Weevil.
Mr. Guppy, sitting on the window-sill, nodding his head and balancing all these possibilities in his mind, continues thoughtfully to tap it, and clasp it, and measure it with his hand, until he hastily draws his hand away. "What in the devil's name," he says, "is this? Look at my fingers." A thick yellow liquor defiles them, which is offensive to the touch and sight, and more offensive to the smell. A stagnant, sickening oil with some natural repulsion in it that makes them both shudder. "What have you been doing here? What have you been pouring out of window?"
"I pouring out of window? Nothing, I swear, never since I've been here," cries the lodger.
"And yet look here, and look here." When he brings the candle here from the corner of the window-sill, it slowly drips and creeps away down the bricks. Here lies in a little thick, nauseous pool. "This is a horrible house," says Mr. Guppy, shutting down the window. "Give me some water, I shall cut my hand off." He so washes and rubs and scrubs and smells and washes that he has not long restored himself with a glass of brandy and stood silently before the fire when St. Paul's bell strikes 12, and all those other bells strike 12 from their towers of various heights in the dark air and in their many tones. When all is quiet again, the lodger says,
"It's the appointed time at last. Shall I go?"
Mr. Guppy nods and gives him a lucky touch on the back, but not with a washed hand, though it is his right hand. He goes downstairs, and Mr. Guppy tries to compose himself before the fire for waiting a long time. But in no more than a minute or two the stairs creak, and Tony comes swiftly back.
"Have you got them?"
"Got them? No. The old man's not there."
He has been so horribly frightened in the short interval that his terror seizes the other, who makes a rush at him and asks loudly, "What's the matter?"
"I couldn't make him hear, and I softly opened the door and looked in. And the burning smell is there, and the soot is there, and the oil is there, and he is not there."
Tony ends this with a groan. Mr. Guppy takes the light. They go down, more dead than alive, and holding one another, push open the door of the back shop. The cat has retreated close to it, and stands snarling, not at them, at something on the ground before the fire. There is a very little fire left in the grate, but there is a smouldering, suffocating vapour in the room, and a dark, greasy coating on the walls and ceiling. The chairs and table, and the bottle so rarely absent from the table, all stand as usual. On one chair back hang the old man's hairy cap and coat.
"Look,"
whispers the lodger, pointing his friend's attention to these objects with a trembling finger.
"I told you so. When I saw him last, he took his cap off, took out the little bundle of old letters, hung his cap on the back of the chair. His coat was there already, for he had pulled that off before he went to put the shutters up. And I left him, turning the letters over in his hand, standing just where that crumbled black thing is upon the floor."
Is he hanging somewhere? They look up. No.
See, whispers Tony. At the foot of the same chair there lies a dirty bit of thin red cord that they tie up pens with. That went round the lettuce. He undid it slowly, leering and laughing at me before he began to turn them over, and threw it there. I saw it fall.
What's the matter with the cat? Says Mr. Guppy. Look at her.
Mad, I think. And no wonder in this evil place.
They advance slowly, looking at all these things. The cat remains where they found her, still snarling at the something on the ground before the fire and between the two chairs. What is it? Hold up the light. Here is a small burnt patch of flooring. Here is the tinder from a little bundle of burnt paper, but not so light as usual, seeming to be steeped in something. And here is it the cinder of a small charred and broken log of wood, sprinkled with white ashes? Or is it coal? Oh, horror! He is here. And this from which we run away, striking out the light and overturning one another into the street, is all that represents him. Help, 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 come into this house for heaven's sake. Plenty will come in, but none can help. The Lord Chancellor of that court, true to his title in his last act, has died the death of all Lord Chancellors in all courts, and of all authorities in all places under all names soever, where false pretences are made, and where injustice is done. Call the death by any name your Highness will, attribute it to whom you will, or say it might have been prevented how you will, it is the same death eternally, inborn, inbred, engendered in the corrupted humours of the vicious body itself, and that only. Spontaneous combustion, and none other of all the deaths that can be died. Chapter 33. Interlopers. Now do those two gentlemen, not very neat about the cuffs and buttons, who attended the last coroner's inquest at the Sol's Arms, reappear in the precincts with surprising swiftness, being in fact breathlessly fetched by the active and intelligent Beadle, and institute perquisitions through the court, and dive into the Sol's parlour, and write with ravenous little pens on tissue paper. Now do they note down, in the watches of the night, how the neighbourhood of Chancery Lane was yesterday, at about midnight, thrown into a state of the most intense agitation and excitement by the following alarming and horrible discovery. Now do they set forth how it will doubtless be remembered that some time back a painful sensation was created in the public mind by a case of mysterious death from opium occurring in the first floor of the house occupied as a rag bottle and general marine store shop by an eccentric individual of intemperate habits far advanced in life named Crook. And how, by a remarkable coincidence, Crook was examined at the inquest, which it may be recollected was held on that occasion at the Sol's Arms, a well-conducted tavern immediately adjoining the premises in question on the west side, and licensed to a highly respectable landlord, Mr. James George Bogsby. Now do they show, in as many words as possible, how, during some hours of yesterday evening, a very peculiar smell was observed by the inhabitants of the court, in which the tragical occurrence which forms the subject of that present account transpired, and which odour was at one time so powerful that Mr. Swills, a comic vocalist professionally engaged by Mr. J. G. Bogsby, has himself stated to our reporter that he mentioned to Miss M. Melvilleson, a lady of some pretensions to musical ability, likewise engaged by Mr. J. G. Bogsby to sing at a series of concerts called Harmonic Assemblies, or Meetings, which it would appear are held at the Sol's Arms under Mr. Bogsby's direction, pursuant to the Act of George the Second, that he, Mr. Swills, found his voice seriously affected by the impure state of the atmosphere, his jocose expression at the time being that he was like an empty post-office, for he hadn't a single note in him. How this account of Mr. Swills is entirely corroborated by two intelligent married females residing in the same court and known respectively by the names of Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins, both of whom observed the fetid effluvia and regarded them as being emitted from the premises in the occupation of Crook, the unfortunate deceased. All this, and a great deal more, the two gentlemen who have formed an amicable partnership in the melancholy catastrophe write down on the spot. And the boy population of the court, out of bed in a moment, swarm up the shutters of the Sol's Arms parlour to behold the tops of their heads while they are about it. The whole court, adult as well as boy, is sleepless for that night, and can do nothing but wrap up its many heads, and talk of the ill-fated house, and look at it. Miss Flight has been bravely rescued from her chamber, as if it were in flames, and accommodated with a bed at the Sol's Arms. The Sol neither turns off its gas, nor shuts its door all night, for any kind of public excitement makes good for the Sol, and causes the court to stand in need of comfort. The house has not done so much in the stomachic article of cloves or in brandy and water warm since the inquest. The moment the potboy heard what had happened, he rolled up his shirt sleeves tight to his shoulders and said, "There'll be a run upon us." In the first outcry, young Piper dashed off for the fire engines and returned in triumph at a jolting gallop perched up aloft on the Phoenix and holding on to that fabulous creature with all his might in the midst of helmets and torches. One helmet remains behind after careful investigation of all chinks and crannies, and slowly paces up and down before the house in company with one of the two policemen, who have likewise been left in charge thereof. To this trio everybody in the court possessed of sixpence has an insatiate desire to exhibit hospitality in a liquid form. Mr. Weevil and his friend Mr. Guppy are within the bar at the Sol, and are worth anything to the Sol that the bar contains if they will only stay there.
"This is not the time," says Mr. Bogsby, "to haggle about money."
Though he looks something sharply after it over the counter.
"Give your orders, you two gentlemen, and you're welcome to whatever you put a name to."
Thus entreated, the two gentlemen, Mr. Weevil especially, put names to so many things that in course of time they find it difficult to put a name to anything quite distinctly, though they still relate to all newcomers some version of the night they have had of it, and of what they said, and what they thought, and what they saw. Meanwhile, one or other of the policemen often flits about the door, and pushing it open a little way at the full length of his arm, looks in from outer gloom. Not that he has any suspicions, but that he may as well know what they are up to in there. Thus night pursues its leaden course, finding the court still out of bed through the unwonted hours, still treating and being treated, still conducting itself similarly to a court that has had a little money left it unexpectedly. Thus night at length with slow retreating steps departs, and the lamplighter going his rounds, like an executioner to a despotic king, strikes off the little heads of fire that have aspired to lessen the darkness. Thus the day cometh, whether or no. And the day may discern, even with its dim London eye, that the court has been up all night. Over and above the faces that have fallen drowsily on tables, and the heels that lie prone on hard floors instead of beds, the brick-and-mortar physiognomy of the very court itself looks worn and jaded. And now the neighbourhood, waking up and beginning to hear of what has happened, comes streaming in, half-dressed, to ask questions. And the two policemen and the helmet, who are far less impressible externally than the court, have enough to do to keep the door.
"Good gracious, gentlemen," says Mr. Snagsby, coming up. "What's this I hear?"
"Why, it's true," returns one of the policemen. "That's what it is. Now move on here, come."
"Why, good gracious, gentlemen," says Mr. Snagsby, somewhat promptly backed away. "I was at this door last night, betwixt 10 and 11 o'clock, in conversation with the young man who lodges here."
"Indeed," returns the policeman. "You will find the young man next door, then. Now move on here, some of you."
"Not hurt, I hope," says Mr. Snagsby.
"Hurt? No. What's to hurt him?"
Mr. Snagsby, wholly unable to answer this or any question in his troubled mind, repairs to the Sol's Arms and finds Mr. Weevil languishing over tea and toast with a considerable expression on him of exhausted excitement and exhausted tobacco smoke.
"And Mr. Guppy likewise," quoth Mr. Snagsby. "Dear, dear, dear, what a fate there seems in all this! And my lit—"
Mr. Snagsby's power of speech deserts him in the formation of the words, "my little woman." For to see that injured female walk into the Sol's Arms at that hour of the morning and stand before the beer engine, with her eyes fixed upon him like an accusing spirit, strikes him dumb.
"My dear," says Mr. Snagsby, when his tongue is loosened, "will you take anything? A little, not to put too fine a point upon it, drop of shrub?"
"No," says Mrs. Snagsby.
"My love, you know these two gentlemen?"
"Yes,"
says Mrs. Snagsby, and in a rigid manner acknowledges their presence, still fixing Mr. Snagsby with her eye. The devoted Mr. Snagsby cannot bear this treatment. He takes Mrs. Snagsby by the hand and leads her aside to an adjacent cask.
"My little woman, why do you look at me in that way? Pray don't do it."
"I can't help my looks," says Mrs. Snagsby, "and if I could, I wouldn't."
Mr. Snagsby, with his cough of meekness, rejoins,
"Wouldn't you really, my dear?"
and meditates. Then coughs his cough of trouble and says, "This is a dreadful mystery, my love," still fearfully disconcerted by Mrs. Snagsby's eye.
"It is," returns Mrs. Snagsby, shaking her head, "a dreadful mystery."
"My little woman," urges Mr. Snagsby, in a piteous manner,
"don't, for goodness sake, speak to me with that bitter expression, and look at me in that searching way. I beg and entreat of you not to do it. Good Lord, you don't suppose that I would go spontaneously combusting any person, my dear?"
"I can't say," returns Mrs. Snagsby.
On a hasty review of his unfortunate position, Mr. Snagsby can't say either. He's not prepared positively to deny that he may have had something to do with it. He has had something, he don't know what, to do with so much in this connection that is mysterious, that it is possible he may even be implicated, without knowing it, in the present transaction. He faintly wipes his forehead with his handkerchief and gasps,
"My life," says the unhappy stationer, "would you have any objections to mention why, being in general so delicately circumspect in your conduct, you come into a wine vault before breakfast?"
"Why do you come here?" inquires Mrs. Snagsby. "My dear, merely to know the rights of the fatal accident which has happened to the venerable party who has been combusted." Mr. Snagsby has made a pause to suppress a groan. "I should then have related them to you, my love, over your French roll."
"I dare say you would. You relate everything to me, Mr. Snagsby."
"I should be glad," says Mrs. Snagsby, after contemplating his increased confusion with a severe and sinister smile, "if you would come home with me. I think you may be safer there, Mr. Snagsby, than anywhere else." "My love, I don't know but what I may be, I'm sure. I'm ready to go."
Mr. Snagsby casts his eye forlornly round the bar, gives Messrs. Weevil and Guppy good morning, assures them of the satisfaction with which he sees them uninjured, and accompanies Mrs. Snagsby from the Sol's Arms. Before night, his doubt whether he may not be responsible for some inconceivable part in a catastrophe, which is the talk of the whole neighbourhood, is almost resolved into certainty by Mrs. Snagsby's pertinacity in that fixed gaze. His mental sufferings are so great that he entertains wandering ideas of delivering himself up to justice and requiring to be cleared if innocent and punished with the utmost rigour of the law if guilty. Mr. Weevil and Mr. Guppy, having taken their breakfast, step into Lincoln's Inn to take a little walk about the square and clear as many of the dark cobwebs out of their brains as a little walk may.
"There can be no more favourable time than the present, Tony," says Mr. Guppy, after they have broodingly made out the four sides of the square, "for a word or two between us upon a point on which we must, with very little delay, come to an understanding."
"Now, I'll tell you what, William G.,"
returns the other, eyeing his companion with a bloodshot eye,
"if it's a point of conspiracy, you needn't take the trouble to mention it. I've had enough of that, and I ain't going to have any more. We shall have you taking fire next, or blowing up with a bang."
This supposititious phenomenon is so very disagreeable to Mr. Guppy that his voice quakes as he says in a moral way,
"Tony, I should have thought that what we went through last night would have been a lesson to you never to be personal any more as long as you lived."
To which Mr. Weevil returns,
"William, I should have thought it would have been a lesson to you never to conspire any more as long as you lived."
To which Mr. Guppy says,
"Who's conspiring?"
To which Mr. Jobling replies,
"Why, you are."
To which Mr. Guppy retorts,
"No, I'm not."
To which Mr. Jobling retorts again,
"Yes, you are."
To which Mr. Guppy retorts,
"Who says so?"
To which Mr. Jobling retorts,
"I say so."
To which Mr. Guppy retorts,
"Oh, indeed."
To which Mr. Jobling retorts,
"Yes, indeed."
And both being now in a heated state, they walk on silently for a while to cool down again. "Tony," says Mr. Guppy then, "if you heard your friend out, instead of flying at him, you wouldn't fall into mistakes. But your temper is hasty, and you are not considerate. Possessing in yourself, Tony, all that is calculated to charm the eye—"
"I'll blow the eye,"
cries Mr. Weevil, cutting him short.
"Say what you've got to say."
Finding his friend in this morose and material condition, Mr. Guppy only expresses the finer feelings of his soul through the tone of injury in which he recommences.
"Tony,
When I say there is a point on which we must come to an understanding pretty soon, I say so quite apart from any kind of conspiring, however innocent. You know it is professionally arranged beforehand in all cases that are tried what facts the witnesses are to prove. Is it, or is it not desirable that we should know what facts we are to prove on the inquiry into the death of this unfortunate old gentleman? Mr. Guppy was going to say mogul, but thinks gentleman better suited to the circumstances.
What facts? The facts.
The facts bearing on that inquiry. Those are, Mr. Guppy tells them off on his fingers, what we knew of his habits, when you saw him last, what his condition was then, the discovery that we made, and how we made it.
Yes, says Mr. Weevil, those are about the facts.
We made the discovery in consequence of his having, in his eccentric way, an appointment with you at 12 o'clock at night, when you were to explain some writing to him, as you had often done before, on account of his not being able to read. I, spending the evening with you, was called down, and so forth. The inquiry being only into the circumstances touching the death of the deceased, it is not necessary to go beyond these facts. I suppose you'll agree?
No, returns Mr. Weevil. I suppose not.
And this is not a conspiracy, perhaps? Says the injured Guppy.
No, returns his friend. If it's nothing worse than this, I'll withdraw the observation.
Now, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, taking his arm again and walking him slowly on, I should like to know, in a friendly way, whether you have yet thought over the many advantages of your continuing to live at that place.
What do you mean?
Says Tony, stopping. Whether you have yet thought over the many advantages of your continuing to live at that place, repeats Mr. Guppy, walking him on again.
But what place? That place?
Pointing in the direction of the rag and bottle shop. Mr. Guppy nods.
Why, I wouldn't pass another night there for any consideration that you could offer me,
says Mr. Weevil, haggardly staring. Do you mean it, though, Tony?
Mean it? Do I look as if I mean it? I feel as if I do, I know that,
says Mr. Weevil with a very genuine shudder. Then the possibility, or probability, for such it must be considered, of your never being disturbed in possession of those effects lately belonging to a lone old man who seemed to have no relation in the world, and the certainty of your being able to find out what he really had got stored up there, don't weigh with you at all against last night, Tony, if I understand you, says Mr. Guppy, biting his thumb with the appetite of vexation.
Certainly not. Talking that cool way of a fellow's living there,
cries Mr. Weevil indignantly.
Go and live there yourself.
Oh, I, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, soothing him, I have never lived there, and couldn't get a lodging there now, whereas you have got one.
You're welcome to it,
rejoins his friend,
and, ugh, you may make yourself at home in it.
Then you really and truly at this point, says Mr. Guppy, give up the whole thing, if I understand you, Tony.
You never,
returns Tony with a most convincing steadfastness,
said a truer word in all your life. I do.
While they're so conversing, a hackney coach drives into the square, on the box of which vehicle a very tall hat makes itself manifest to the public. Inside the coach, and consequently not so manifest to the multitude, though sufficiently so to the two friends, for the coach stops almost at their feet, are the venerable Mr. Smallweed and Mrs. Smallweed, accompanied by their granddaughter Judy. An air of haste and excitement pervades the party, and as the tall hat, surmounting Mr. Smallweed the younger, alights, Mr. Smallweed the elder pokes his head out of window and bawls to Mr. Guppy,
"Howdy do, sir, howdy do!"
"What do Chick and his family want here at this time of the morning, I wonder?" says Mr. Guppy, nodding to his familiar.
"My dear sir," cries Grandfather Smallweed, "would you do me a favour? Would you and your friend be so very obliging as to carry me into the public house in the court, while Bart and his sister bring their grandmother along? Would you do an old man that good turn, sir?"
Mr. Guppy looks at his friend, repeating inquiringly, "The public house in the court?" And they prepare to bear the venerable burden to the soul's arms.
"There's your fare,"
says the patriarch to the coachman, with a fierce grin, and shaking his incapable fist at him.
"Ask me for a penny more, and I'll have my lawful revenge upon you. My dear young man, be easy with me, if you please. Allow me to catch you round the neck. I won't squeeze you tighter than I can help. Oh, Lord, oh, dear me, oh, my bones!"
It is well that the soul is not far off.
for Mr. Weevil presents an apoplectic appearance before half the distance is accomplished. With no worse aggravation of his symptoms, however, than the utterance of diverse croaking sounds expressive of obstructive respiration, he fulfills his share of the porterage, and the benevolent old gentleman is deposited by his own desire in the parlour of the Soul's Arms.
"Oh, Lord!" gasps Mr. Smallweed, looking about him breathless from an armchair. "Oh, dear me! Oh, my bones and back! Oh, my aches and pains! Oh, sit down, you dancing, prancing, shambling, scrambling poll parrot! Sit down!"
This little apostrophe to Mrs. Smallweed is occasioned by propensity on the part of that unlucky old lady, whenever she finds herself on her feet, to amble about and set to inanimate objects, accompanying herself with a chattering noise as in a witch dance. A nervous affection has probably as much to do with these demonstrations as any imbecile intention in the poor old woman. But on the present occasion they are so particularly lively in connection with the Windsor armchair, fellow to that in which Mr. Smallweed is seated, that she only quite desists when her grandchildren have held her down in it, her lord in the meanwhile bestowing upon her, with great volubility, the endearing epithet of "a pig-headed jackdaw," repeated a surprising number of times.
"My dear sir,"
Grandfather Smallweed then proceeds, addressing Mr. Guppy,
"there has been a calamity here. Have you heard of it, either of you?"
"Heard of it, sir? Why, we discovered it."
"You discovered it? You discovered it? Bart, they discovered it!"
The two discoverers stare at the Smallweeds, who return the compliment.
"My dear friends,"
whines Grandfather Smallweed, putting out both his hands,
"I owe you a thousand thanks for discharging the melancholy office of discovering the ashes of Mrs. Smallweed's brother."
"Eh?" says Mr. Guppy.
"Mrs. Smallweed's brother, my dear friend, her only relation. We were not on terms, which is to be deplored now, but he never would be on terms. He was not fond of us. He was eccentric. He was very eccentric. Unless he has left a will, which is not at all likely, I shall take out letters of administration. I've come down to look after the property. It must be sealed up. It must be protected. I have come down,"
repeats Grandfather Smallweed, hooking the air towards him with all his 10 fingers at once,
"to look after the property."
"I think, Small," says the disconsolate Mr. Guppy, "you might have mentioned that the old man was your uncle."
"You two were so close about him that I thought you would like me to be the same,"
returns that old bird with a secretly glistening eye.
"Besides, I wasn't proud of him."
"Besides which, it was nothing to you, you know, whether he was or not,"
says Judy, also with a secretly glistening eye.
"He never saw me in his life to know me," observed Small. "I don't know why I should introduce him, I'm sure."
"No, he never communicated with us, which is to be deplored,"
the old gentleman strikes in.
"But I've come to look after the property, to look after the papers, and to look after the property. We shall make good our title. It is in the hands of my solicitor, Mr. Tulkinghorn, of Lincoln's Inn Fields, over the way there. He's so good as to act as my solicitor, and grass don't grow under his feet, I can tell you. Crook was Mrs. Smallweed's only brother. She had no relation but Crook, and Crook had no relation but Mrs. Smallweed. I'm speaking of your brother, you brimstone black beetle, that was 76 years of age."
Mrs. Smallweed instantly begins to shake her head and pipe up,
£76.7 and 7, 76,000 bags of money, 76,000 million of parcels of banknotes."
"Will somebody give me a quart pot?"
exclaims her exasperated husband, looking helplessly about him and finding no missile within his reach.
"Will somebody oblige me with a spittoon? Will somebody hand me anything hard and bruising to pelt at her? You hag, you cat, you dog, you brimstone barker!"
Here Mr. Smallweed, wrought up to the highest pitch by his own eloquence, actually throws Judy at her grandmother in default of anything else, by butting that young virgin at the old lady with such force as he could muster, and then dropping into his chair in a heap.
"Shake me up, somebody, if you'll be so good,"
says the voice from within the faintly struggling bundle into which he has collapsed.
"I've come to look after the property. Shake me up, and call in the police on duty at the next house to be explained to about the property. My solicitor will be here presently to protect the property. Transportation or the gallows for anybody who shall touch the property."
As his dutiful grandchildren set him up, panting, and putting him through the usual restorative process of shaking and punching, he still repeats, like an echo,
"The property! The property! Property!"
Mr. Weevil and Mr. Guppy look at each other, the former as having relinquished the whole affair, the latter with a discomfited countenance as having entertained some lingering expectations yet. But there is nothing to be done in opposition to the Smallweed interest. Mr. Tulkinghorn's clerk comes down from his official pew in the chambers to mention to the police that Mr. Tulkinghorn is answerable for its being all correct about the next of kin, and that the papers and effects will be formally taken possession of in due time and course. Mr. Smallweed is at once permitted so far to assert his supremacy as to be carried on a visit of sentiment into the next house, and upstairs into Miss Flight's deserted room, where he looks like a hideous bird of prey newly added to her aviary. The arrival of this unexpected heir, soon taking wind in the court, still makes good for the soul and keeps the court upon its mettle,